Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The idea of him not going seems to send a signal that the plan won't be particularly strong. So I think our allies and partners will be fine with Morrison not going if his government puts forward a plan that's in line with the science and is much more ambitious. This debate in Australia seems to be pretty much a parallel universe. There's so much focus in the government's own debate about net zero by 2050 or not, when everybody else is focused on 2030.
Hello, good people of podcasts. Welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy, the host and a political editor of Guardian Australia. And we are doing my favourite genre of episode today with the team, COVID safe, obviously, in the pod cave from Canberra. We're doing one of our regular Ask Us Anything episodes. Sadly, Sarah Martin's not with us today because she's just on a day off, but I have with me, introduce yourselves.
Amy Remakis.
Daniel Hurst.
And Paul Karp.
Also known as the Dream Team. So let's kick off with your questions. Now, forgive me in advance if I mangle people's handles or names, or and also understand that some of these questions are abridged versions of what you put to us on the socials. But we're going to start with Paul and vaccine mandates. This one is from, first one I can't work out, goal sneak. Goal sneak or possibly jail sneak.
Oh, like old school.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, look, not sure. Anyway, goal sneak.
No
Let's
longer
go with
permissible
that.
Under Scott Morrison's No More Anonymous Accounts edict.
That's a whole other edict. Anyway, goal sneak, apologies if I've stuffed that up, asks us, will vaccine mandates cause a big divide in society between the haves and have-nots? Paul, take that in the spirit in which it's intended.
Well, I think there are two concepts here, vaccine mandates and vaccine passports. So the mandates are requiring people in certain jobs to get vaccinated if they want to keep coming to work. So that started with aged care and now healthcare. And some states have much longer lists, especially Victoria, have much longer lists of pretty much every public servant needing to have a jab. And so I think that a lot of those people will already be vaccinated. The ones that aren't face a tough choice about whether or not they want to keep their job. So this could coerce them to getting the vaccine. There are a few legal challenges around trying to stop that, but they're not very promising.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because I think that point early in the piece, without getting too bogged down in the legalities, was the default legal view was this would be a lawful direction if your employer said you must get a vaccine in order to be in this workplace, right? Is that right?
Oh, so that is just a private business requiring, and yet the government's view is that it's lawful to require them. But this, the mandates is a step above that.
Yes.
Because they have all the force of the public health orders.
Yes.
Behind them. And I think those laws will withstand challenge just as they have every other time in the pandemic. So that's the mandates. And then there's the related issue of vaccine passports, which is if you've been vaccinated, you get extra freedoms at the 70 and 80% vaccination rates. And that's a feature of the Victorian and the New South Wales reopening roadmaps in particular. And I think that this is really going to depend on enforcement. Like, are cafes, restaurants, bars going to pay someone to force everyone to show them their vaccine passport? Because if they don't do that, then it could be like the QR code where, you know, everyone is very correct about it for the first week or two and then sort of lets it slide and no one checks it. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, you know, you could be unvaccinated and, you know, not have to show it that often and carry on with all the same freedoms as anyone else. There's a real question around that. I don't think the New South Wales government has really explained how that's going to work. And then the other states still really need to explain what they're going to do. I mean, Queensland and other states haven't said whether this is going to be a feature of their reopening roadmaps. The ACT has gone in the opposite direction, saying our vaccine rates are going to be so high and there are human rights concerns with requiring people to be vaccinated to do this and that in their everyday life. So we're not going to have them at all. But it's really going to depend on whether anyone is going to ask you to show it. Travelling internationally, you will have to show your vaccine status. But the pub,
who knows?
Are they going to call the cops?
But it's also, though, I suppose, whether or not it causes social tensions, like in your friendship groups. And, you know, like, are you going to think about whether you invite somebody around for, you know, a sneaky something or other, if they're vaccinated or not?
I think that'll depend on whether people have unvaccinated children, probably more than anything. Because, I mean, the vaccination rates in Australia are overwhelmingly good.
Yeah.
Like, we've adopted vaccination en masse, basically. So it's not as big an issue as it is in the United States,
yes,
despite how loud the anti-vaxxers and the people who are against the mandates have been in the protests and how much attention it's getting.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly,
yeah,
the vast majority.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when it comes to those social things you're talking about, it will come down to, do you have young children in the house who can't get the vaccination? Do you have anyone who's immune compromised? Mm-hmm. You know, those sorts of things, they're really going to play on those interpersonal relationships. But I think we've started to see a fracturing of those interpersonal relationships anyway over the pandemic, where people have just been so focused on individual rights. You've already started to see families and friendship groups and even some workplaces just start to go, oh my goodness, I never knew this about you. And you've already started to see those fractures. So I think that'll probably just continue on smaller scales.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And Amy, while you're on a roll, our next question is from David Horn. Thank you, David. Any substance to the persistent rumours of a pre-Christmas election?
Oh, God, it's just an easy one.
Yes.
Like, of course there is, but then of course there isn't. No one can say for sure when the election is going to be other than Scott Morrison. So there are, you know, commentators such as Dennis Atkins, who's with In Queensland, who has said that he believes it'll be November 27, outlining all of his reasons for that, which would make sense for certain states, but not all of them. So Queensland, WA will still be closed. So will the Northern Territory. You know, South Australia is opening up, but, you know, whether they're opening up to mass travel with an election campaign is something different. We don't know what Tasmania is doing. So that cuts down on how many states the leaders can actually go to, the
yes.
campaign can go to.
Yes.
We know that there have been plans put in place for a virtual campaign on both sides, like just in case borders are still closed. But we don't know when Scott Morrison is thinking about going to the election, because prime ministers always call them when it's best for them.
Yeah, when it suits them.
And is it best for Scott Morrison right now? We're about to see massive stress on the health and hospital system. We've got Queensland and WA and Victoria, populations where they're not overly enamoured of the coalition at the moment, and they're facing losing seats or at least, you know, massive hurdles in those places. You've got New South Wales, which will be on a high because of the reopening, but then there's going to be other issues that come, you know, from that. Mm-hmm. So is this year the best time to have an election? I would say probably not, but, you know, I'm not the leader of a political party,
Well, the bottom line, as Amy says, is none of us know, anyone in the early, the pre-Christmas election camp?
I get the feeling Morrison's warming up. It's sort of, I'm here to give you your freedoms. You can see the lines sort of starting to develop.
That's certainly true.
You know, we've got to get back to normal. I'm the only one who has the stomach to actually push for this and do this. So I wouldn't, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised is all the best I can put it, I guess.
I think he's talking like one is close and that he wants people to remember that he was in favour of their freedoms, but I don't think that necessarily means the poll itself will be this year, because we saw in Queensland and WA, Labor governments re-elected with massive margins in the case of WA because they were in favour of keeping the borders closed. Mm. And so, Morrison would have the difficulty of the perception that he wants to bust those states open and find himself campaigning against very popular Labor premiers against a very popular COVID-zero policy.
And there's one more. There's one more element to that, which is also that you're being tricky, and that you're going because you think if you wait, things will get worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But again, I think we're all in furious agreement that we don't know. But this is our best thoughts on balance of probabilities. We're going to Daniel now.
I was just going to say, if there's a virtual campaign, does that mean in the leaders' debate, the voters can mute the leaders?
I think it just means there'll be like Tupac-style holograms, as Paul and I were talking about.
Please, oh ABBA-style holograms.
Oh, my God, the possibilities are endless.
Choose
okay. Daniel, this is from Pup Fiction, not Pulp Fiction, Pup Fiction, thank you. If Morrison doesn't go to the COP in November, this is for those of you who don't speak climate change, this is the UN-led summit in Glasgow to determine the next round of international climate commitments. So if the Prime Minister doesn't go, will our allies be pissed off?
They could be if it's accompanied by a very weak climate plan. So, the UK High Commissioner has said that the UK, which is the host, would be disappointed if Morrison didn't go. But I think the idea of him not going seems to send a signal that the plan won't be particularly strong. So I think our allies and partners will be fine with Morrison not going, really, if his government puts forward a plan that's in line with the science and is much more ambitious. Mm. This debate in Australia seems to be pretty much a parallel universe. Like, there's so much focus in the government's own debate about net zero by 2050 or not, when everybody else is focused on 2030. It's been two or three years since the IPCC said that to keep 1.5 degrees within reach, you need to have net zero by around 2050 and also have a 45% cut by 2030. Ours is 26 to 28%, and it really isn't. It doesn't stack up anymore.
Well, Scott Morrison's still talking about the carbon tax. When was the last time anyone seriously suggested that?
We certainly are in the time warp. And, look, I agree I think the whole Willie or why do you go to Glasgow debate is kind of ridiculous. It's, again, sort of focusing on the signal rather than on the substance. I mean, what matters is what Australia does. I suppose I'd only add...
The fear is it's accompanied by a dodgy policy.
Of course, yes, and that's absolutely right. I'd add just one other thought into the mix. Just about that, and if you've been watching events this week, you'll have seen Metropolitan Liberals lining up to campaign for a net zero target. You have also seen the Nationals lining up against a net zero target, or at least putting major asks in front of their eventual agreement. If I was Scott Morrison and I just landed a new climate policy, I wouldn't want to leave it to Barnaby Joyce to sell it either. I would want to be here. I would not want to be in Glasgow. Anyway.
Where Malcolm Turnbull will be.
Well, there is that too. There is that too. Thank you, Daniel. So, Paul, we'll come back to you. So, for obvious reasons, for the last week or so, integrity commissions have been well and truly to the fore. So this is a sort of an amalgamated question from Michael Carey and Thomas Parks, who both ask similar questions along these lines. What policies will the Liberals produce on integrity between now and the election, and will we see an ICAC between now and the putative election?
So the government has a bill for a very softly integrity commission model that was released in November last year, and that's much weaker than the New South Wales ICAC for a whole host of reasons. It only looks at public sector alleged criminality, not other forms of corruption. It doesn't look at the private sector, if the private sector is trying to influence public officials. It wouldn't hold public hearings. It wouldn't make findings of fact that a particular person was corrupt. It would only make investigate, and then it would make referrals to police and prosecutors. So it's a much softer model than what they have in New South Wales. And what we've seen now with Gladys Berejiklian resigning is the government is doubling down on the softly model. They said that the resignation, shows the virtues of the approach that the Commonwealth has taken and the fact that the New South Wales model is too strong. So that's what they'll bowl up in the last sittings of Parliament this year. In terms of what we get and whether anything will get through, well, Labor, the Greens and the crossbench, such as Independent MP Helen Haynes, are definitely up for the fight, up for amending the bill to try and make it tougher. But the issue that you then have is that success in the Senate at amending this bill to be more like what we see in New South Wales, where public hearings are supposed to deter people from corrupt behaviour to begin with, the knowledge that there will be that scrutiny.
Yeah.
Even if they toughen it up to try and get it closer towards that model, you could see a situation where the Senate agrees to a tough bill, the government won't agree to that in the lower house, and we get nothing.
Yep.
So then you'll see lobbying of the Senate crossbench, the Sterling Griffiths of the world. Is nothing really better than something will be the question for them before the election. But I foresee the possibility that it becomes an election issue because we don't have anything by then.
Hmm. Anyone got any alternate thoughts on that?
Well, I think it definitely will be an election issue because you can see how much Labor is focusing on it, and Labor, like the Coalition, are really just starting to distill all of their campaign messages. I mean, we've been in an election campaign for the last 3 months, and now we're starting to really see that, whir up in terms of messaging. It's mentioned in almost every single Labor press conference. National Integrity Commission like ICAC, they would only be mentioning that if they're hearing that it's something that is bothering people. And I think the most recent events in New South Wales has probably led to a flashpoint in that the government thinks it's got something it can hang its views and opinions on why it can't be as strong as ICAC. But we're about to go into a couple of weeks of pretty intense ICAC hearings, which might not make the government's position quite as tenable, as we start to move forward. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think we're probably going to land, as Paul says, in a situation where it'll be, is something better than nothing? At the moment, those in favour of a Federal Integrity Commission think that the government's position is pretty much nothing anyway, mm-hmm. and would actually set back the chances of a proper integrity commission with teeth.
Just quickly, Paul, what's your own view? Is something better than nothing?
This body, I don't think, answers the description of what people want, which is, we already have police. We already have the Crime and Intelligence Commission. There are already bodies that investigate criminal offences. I think what most people think of with an anti-corruption body is some form of falling short on your duty or perversion of that duty that falls short of being a crime.
Yeah.
So I don't have any problem with there being another agency investigating crimes, but I don't think it answers the description of what people want.
Mm, okay. Amy, back to you now, love. This one's from Chris O'Keefe. Thank you, Chris. Who asks, what's the deal with Shorten stalking Albo? Any prospect of Shorten rolling Albo before the election? Amy?
I don't think there's any prospect of a Labor leadership change before the election, mostly because there doesn't seem to be much appetite for it, among the party leadership or, the front bench and the party itself, but also the members, I think, would absolutely revolt if Labor was to do a switcheroo
before the next election. It just, it would be just a way of just basically waving the white flag immediately, I think. But I think, like, Bill Shorten is always going to just cause a little bit of trouble behind the scenes, because that's what Bill Shorten has done for, you know, since he lost the leadership. That's not going to change. Joel Fitzgibbon is going to continue to cause trouble behind the scenes until he, you know, leaves the parliament. You're always going to have that sort of discontent within political parties. But I do not think that there's any chance of a Labor leadership change.
Anyone got a different view to that?
I would think that, although it's very unlikely, that there would be more of a chance on the government side. I mean,
whoa, shots fired, Paul Cupp. Yes, why?
Well, because it's done for PM,
dangerous times always.
Yeah, when Morrison's popularity has gone low, there's been like in Dutton that there's a more natural successor, whereas I don't think that's the case on the Labor side.
Yeah.
But again, very unlikely on either side.
Yes, yeah, probably, on balance. Okay, where are we at? Daniel, the Victorian Nationals haven't exactly welcomed the return of Barnaby Joyce. Sorry, this question.
Understatement of the decade.
Well, I don't know Andrew Cole, who proposed this question, but he's clearly a diplomat. So anyway, he says, the Victorian Nationals haven't welcomed the return of Barnaby Joyce. Could the LNP split over climate change? Now, there's a couple of... you have a go at that, Daniel.
Well, I first thought of those, was he talking about within the Nats? And I wouldn't have thought... I mean, there's a bit of product differentiation going on, but I wouldn't have thought there'd be, a serious split within the Nats. Clearly, the Victorian Nats, including Darren Chester, who's a significant figure there, have been a little bit more forward-leaning when it comes to accepting the need for climate action, not so much focused on the costs of acting, but more the costs of not acting, and also the impacts on regional communities and the fact that regional Australians in many cases do want to be involved in helping to manage the transition and play an active role in environmental stewardship. Now, certainly within the coalition, there's a raging fight going on between the Nats and the Libs, but it's not so... It's also not so simple as Nats versus Libs. You know a lot better. This is a meme, Murph, but like the Queensland Nats seem to be the main sort of pushback, and there's a bit of nuance. Like Michael McCormack told you recently that the Nats need to seriously consider net zero.
This is why I slightly hesitated when I put the question to you, not because I didn't think you could answer it, but because there's just in the framing of the question, Andrew, I hope we're getting it right in terms of getting to the bottom of what you ask, because I wasn't sure, and Daniel's diagnosed the condition at this point in terms of the raging argument between Libs and Nats and all the nuances therein. But if you were asking, I guess, if you were looking at that in a Queensland prism, could the fight over climate change break up the LNP as an entity? See, I don't know if you mean that, Andrew, but if you do, let's have a think about that for 2 minutes. Any prospect of that over climate change?
Well, that has been something that's been an issue for the Queensland LNP since Lawrence Springborg first came up with the idea of, a formal marriage between the parties. And they've come up against a lot of challenges, from fundraising and how the executive is run to what happened when Campbell Newman was a Liberal Premier with, Jeff Sini, the Nationals' Deputy Premier, and what happened within the state LNP then. But the thing is, Barnaby Joyce is quite sympathetic to the Queensland Nationals, or the Queensland LNP people who sit in the National Party room, and he always has been, having started there himself as a, way back when he was in the Senate. So Barnaby Joyce is managing to corral them in a way that I don't think you could see Michael McCormack do.
Yes. Yeah.
Whether or not it's enough to split, I don't think you would actually see that, because the Nationals need the Liberals as much as the Liberals need the Nationals, and that's why the marriage happened.
And the election's getting closer, so nobody wants to have, there's the sort of imperative of obviously North Queensland LNP candidates and MPs will express a very different position potentially in public to their constituencies than Southeast Queensland, Liberals.
Yes.
There is an election looming. I'm sure they'll have an accommodation for different parts of the state candidates saying slightly different things, but really a split just before an election, I wouldn't have thought so.
Yeah, well, that's...
They can't afford it.
Well, there's that too. Well, I would always defer to Daniel and Amy, our two resident ex-Brisbaneites.
And I would always defer to Amy.
We all defer to Amy, let's be honest.
Dangerous.
In relation... I can't see the LNP splitting over climate change. Maybe about other things, but not about this, Andrew. Hope that cleared it up. Now, I've got a bunch of questions that we'll kind of use to round out that we haven't really divided up amongst ourselves. So let's just freeform this a bit and see where we end up. So Oliver Pocock asks, how does the recent change of leadership in New South Wales, so this is obviously, you know, the complete disintegration of the Berejiklian-Barilaro government, and a quick change of personnel, how does that affect federal Liberals and Nationals, if at all? It's a good question. What do we reckon?
Well, the biggest impact would be on financial relations because Dominic Perrottet wants a carve-up of the GST to take some of the money that WA got off.
And we just
heard Morrison is lock, stock and barrel with WA that the GST formula is not changing. But there are other financial arguments to be had, like there's hospital funding. New South Wales agreed with all other states and territories in calling for more hospital funding. So Dominic Perrottet could take that issue up to Morrison. Really, I think the biggest change is Perrottet, more than Gladys, is going to try and speed up the pathway out of COVID restrictions. And I'm not sure that's going to create an argument with Morrison, but it could inflame tensions between Morrison and other premiers if it doesn't go very well for New South Wales. Mm-hmm. And if other premiers use case numbers in New South Wales to justify borders closed for longer. I think that's how it would play into the National Cabinet argument.
Yeah, that's my gut feeling.
Yeah, I think,
any other thoughts?
I think Dom Perrottet seems to be a very similar politician to Scott Morrison as well, whereas Gladys Berejiklian, you know, was a different type of politician and seemed very loyal to the party. So she didn't really engage in as much state-federal backgrounding as, you know, some of the leaders can do, and she just tended to, you know, be quiet. She kept her barbs, you know, for behind closed doors.
She's sort of notoriously conflict-averse, whereas not all premiers are notoriously conflict-averse.
Yeah, and from what I've seen so far, Dom Perrottet doesn't seem to shy away from conflict, which I think, especially as he's trying to establish who he is as a leader and, you know, which direction he's going to take New South Wales in, could see him butt heads with Scott Morrison over, you know, who has jurisdictional power.
Yeah. All good thoughts. Two more on my list. Let's do this one. This is from Didier Guerin. Goodness me. Should have worked harder on the French. Sorry about that. Who asked?
So should we.
Yes, exactly.
It is a country.
Aujourd'hui.
Oh, wow. Oh, dear. Trey, awful. Anyway, is there an appetite for a third major party of grouped independents in the coming election? What do we reckon? Daniel, you look like you want to just throttle this one.
Maybe. Why don't we just stick with maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, that's a good answer, Paul.
Well, I think the Voices movement and the model that Cathy McGowan had of trying to have a grassroots up approach has been relatively successful. I mean, her passing her seat on to Helen Haynes is, I think that's the first time a seat has ever gone federally from one independent to another. So I think that shows that model of organising works. As to whether or not they would be grouped, It seems that people organising on that model have some similarities in terms of climate change and an integrity commission.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there are some similarities, but probably not enough that they would ever be a party. It's mm-hmm. just how many people can take that model and do that, and will they hold the balance of power?
Mm-hmm. Amy?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. You could have a loose coalition of independents, but you can't have independents in
no,
a party.
No, in a group. Yes, it's sort of it's kind of a contradiction in terms.
The model's meant to be, you know, a strong independent local champion,
yes,
so
exactly.
Not part of the power structure how they're presented.
Yeah,
I think given the voices of movement and just, you know, from what we're seeing from, you know, polling about the shift to independents and other sort of minor parties is what happens with those preference flows. As well. Like, if you're naturally a conservative voter, are you going to be like okay with an independent who's representing you on climate change but fiscally is more conservative? So where do your preferences go and how does that impact the election? So
yeah, I suppose the only other thing I would add to that is obviously we saw this in the last federal election campaign, this mode of organising in 2019. I think we would say from that experience the success was variable. So I think to a large degree, actually, apart from public appetite for whether people want an independent, and as Amy says, like whether traditional Liberal or Labor voters can bring themselves to vote for someone other than their team, in inverted commas, so obviously public appetite matters. But I think what matters most is what these people have learnt from the last election campaign, whether or not there's enough sort of organisational memory in these groups to think seriously about what worked and what didn't and what else you might need to think about in terms of this contest, because obviously the dynamics of this contest are different from the last one. So that'd be my thoughts for what it's worth. So the last one is from Nikolai. So there's quite a bold statement in this question, but I think there's I think there's a reasonable discussion here for us to end on, and I think people will appreciate the honesty of thinking about our methodology as journalists. So that's why we're ending here. As a journalist, Nikolai asks, what's your take on the way the media has essentially dismissed a corruption allegation as no big deal? Now, I can only presume that Nikolai is referring to the reception of Gladys Berejiklian's exit from the premiership of New South Wales last week. Obviously, the media is a big statement, I would say, but anyway, there's a substantial question there. So, Amy, what do you reckon?
I was quite taken aback by a lot of the reaction, not just from the media, inverted quotes, but also just punters and people who took liking a politician and liking what somebody has done for New South Wales and transferred that to, you know, how could this happen? She's just fallen victim to her heart, removing all agency and ignoring the fact that we've known for some time now that Gladys Berejiklian has had some questions to answer. And I read a thread by, I think it was an ex-Chicago Times editor who discussed on the weekend the issue of what's happening with Republicans and Democrats in the United States. And he brought up the term of ethics norming, mm-hmm. which is basically where we are so used to questions and clouds and all the rest of it being raised now, and we just think everybody does it. So we're able to normalise behaviour that perhaps a few years ago, we wouldn't have accepted. We put it all on the same level. Right. And yeah. I think that has really started to creep in to Australian politics. Mm. And that's before we even get into issues of access journalism and, you know, whether some journalists are too close to the people that they're reporting on and all the rest of it. But I think there is such a fatigue around politics where people are so used to politicians perhaps or allegedly not acting in the interests of the people that when things happen, everyone's just kind of like, well, that's normal politics.
Mm, very interesting, love. Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, the sort of idea of scandal overload is troubling. Like, we need, as journalists, we need to hold firm on the idea that these norms need to be upheld. And it's not about removing the presumption of innocence. It's about holding true to norms that need to be upheld and insisting on answers to questions that need to be answered.
Mm, exactly. Paul, you will have thoughts, I know.
I'm not surprised about the way some people have taken it because before Gladys Berejiklian resigned, I actually wondered whether she wouldn't dig in. There seemed to be this assumption that if ICAC called another hearing and said that she was a person of interest, that she would definitely resign. But we've seen in other scandals, both in Australia and overseas, political leaders say, I didn't do it and that should be enough for you. She would have had the excuse of the pandemic, of needing to lead New South Wales out of coronavirus restrictions as an extenuating circumstance to stay. And she is still reasonably popular despite Delta. So I wasn't sure that she'd definitely go. When she did decide to leave, and then there was this outpouring of grief and media felt somehow it was their role to reflect their audience's views about Gladys back to them rather than to try and explain the seriousness of what she had been called to ICAC to talk about. Mm. I mean, I found that outpouring sort of validated my earlier concern that the norm was going to be overlooked, that she was just going to plough through it.
I wonder myself, you know, all really good guys. Thank you. I wonder myself whether there's something. I know this is going to sound really weird, but I'm reading at the moment a book called The Body Keeps the Score, which is about how people process trauma.
Very good book.
It is a fascinating book, except if you want to be terrified about attachment parenting and whether or not you've succeeded or not. But anyway, putting that to one side, obviously there has been a great global, national, international trauma in terms of coronavirus. And I wonder, you know, the premiers have risen, obviously, to national prominence. People, in a strange way, have attached themselves to these figures, who have wielded actual power in a crisis. I just wondered, because it surprised me, sort of the normalising tone of poor Gladys, when obviously there are serious questions to answer. I sort of was a bit taken aback by it. And I wondered just whether or not there was something more primal going on, that it's sort of like, here's a figure, we're used to that figure. That figure has made, well, not all great decisions. Some of them have been totally shit, let's be honest, but has made decisions, we know them, et cetera. What, Paul, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, they stand up every day, so they become like the face of the government, and people have become very reliant on the government for the rules about what they can and can't do to protect them from this deadly disease, for income support, for all these things. And so this conception of the premiers as like state mommy or state daddy, I think is real, and that some people feel like when the cases go down, you know, thank you, Gladys. When the cases go up, only Gladys can protect us. And they feel like this in every state and territory about their leader.
And I just think it's natural. I don't think any of us mean these remarks in any sort of patronising way at all. I just think it's kind of weirdly natural human behaviour to kind of, you know, sort of identify the leader and pattern, you know, sort of the leader sets the tone. Anyway, that's all probably deeper than Nicolai wanted.
Well,
but anyway.
I think the most troubling aspect, though, is the questions it's raised over ICAC and whether it has a role and the commentary around that, because ICAC does not assume guilt. It doesn't assume innocence. It builds a case behind closed doors in what they call in-camera hearings if they think it has enough evidence to move forward with an investigation. And that's it, just an investigation. It then does that. And then we see that investigation play out in the public sphere. It doesn't even lay charges. That's up to, you know, the DPP in New South Wales to decide whether or not. So this idea that we're taking the lionising of a politician that many people, as you've all identified, have attached themselves to because we are in the midst of a pandemic and a huge global trauma. And we're now saying, well, do we even need to have these sorts of investigations because they don't necessarily come up with, you know, black and white answers?
Yeah.
It's quite troubling.
Yeah. Anyone, have we exhausted this or we've got final thoughts?
I was just going to say, yeah, presumption of innocence, the way it's being used, it's almost meaningless, and it's almost got to the point where it only means that we don't like that person is being investigated.
Or has to answer questions.
Yes.
It's sort of.
And it's not a kangaroo court because, you know, as Amy said, it's up to DPP in the future about, you know,
yeah.
whether somebody's liberty is taken away
well,
from them.
Well, yeah, like they can't the
court
convict
process,
anyone.
The actual
yes,
court process,
they
yes.
can't convict anyone. I think there are legitimate arguments about how you constitute these bodies and the limits of them and all of that sort of stuff, but it's been way overworked, some of this in the recent discussion. Anyway, I think sadly that's all we've got time for. I want to thank my team, who, as you can see, are the best in the known universe. I want to thank all you guys for bowling up really good questions. Every time we do these episodes, we get really, really good questions from people, and I'm grateful for that. And we feel like we're here to answer them. So thank you for your input. Thank you to Miles Martignoni, who's the EP of the show. Thank you to Karishma Luthria, who will cut the episode this week. Stay safe. You know the drill. If you're reopening in New South Wales over the next little bit, good luck to you. Stay safe. All of the usual precautions. Take care, and we'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate lightweight, super packable travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.